Hi, it's Tuesday, the Tuesday after Tisha B'Av, and I'm going to do somebody a slight bit different today. But before anything, I want to say that this podcast also is being sponsored by my friends Leventhal family, Dr. Ed Leventhal and his wife, Messa just had a knee replacement yesterday, so we wish her a full shalema, and all the PT should go well. My wife had it, and everything should go good. Ed Leventhal is sponsoring a few of these talks. It makes my life a little bit easier. So we're grateful. And without any further ado, we invite everyone else to imitate him. Without any further ado, I'm going to get to the body of my remarks. I saw a bunch of names were thrown at me whose yards it was, and nothing really clicked with me until I saw somebody unusual, Dr. Deutschlander, who was not a rabbi. I think everybody I've done so far must be famous rabbis, I think. Right? Wasn't necessarily exactly my intention. But I think when I say rabbis, I mean, you know, people smicha, like you imagine rabbonim. Somebody asked me the other day something about the Magen Avraham, relative of his. And I pointed out the Magen Avraham was not a rov. You understand? A lot of people. Now, his Sefer came out and made him world famous. He was a high school Rebbe, as we would call today. Had a small yeshiva katana. The person I'm going to talk about today was Dr. Leo Deutschlander. He's not so well known. Maybe he is. Was also a machanech, which is interesting. I haven't really spoken about people of that type. And when I say machanech, I don't mean the way we use the term very loosely today. Anybody's a Rebbe, you say he's a chinuch. Right? He could be the first grade teacher, he's a chinuch. And it's true, you know. A second grade teacher and a 12th grade teacher, you know, Rebbe is a mechanech, no question about it, or a principal. But I mean mechanech in the bigger picture, in the higher aspect. Anyway, so when I looked at the names, and then I saw Deutschlander, I said, you know, do something a little different. Here is a story of somebody. You may have heard of him in connection with Sarah Schneer, but it's a much bigger life, interesting life. And just that. Well, that's interesting too. But is a person, some people have bad stars, bad mazel, a tough personal life. You know what I'm saying? Some people have difficult lives, sad lives. It's just the way it is. And this is one of them. It's just interesting on a human being level. So who am I talking about? Dr. Leo Deutschlander, Shmuel Deutschlander, with a Yeki. And here we're taking him back, who born 1879. So in other words, here we're going back to somebody who grew up in one world and then had to function in the second world. The German Jews, it's up to World War I and after. Obviously, Hitler's a separate tkufa, of course. But let's put Hitler aside. So before the First World War and after. And the German Jewish story is very interesting in both regards. When I say before the First World War, I have in mind specifically the golden years, if I can use this, of German Jewry and even German Orthodoxy. And that's the Kaiser's time. This is a world of the Yekis that you are familiar with, which really didn't exist until 1860s and 70s. Your image out there of what the Yekis, quote-unquote, are, is actually a modern construction. The way the German Jews crystallized in the modern era, including the Orthodox, happened as, you know, in the 19th century. Before that, there wasn't really much of a difference in fundamentals between a Jew in South Germany, for example, or East Germany, and a Jew in Lithuania, or someplace like that. This is a whole big schmoo, so I'll leave it aside. Now, our hero was born different in the middle of all this. If you're interested in this period, maybe I've mentioned before, I'll mention it again, there's a wonderful book, really a wonderful book, called Modernity Within Tradition. I recommend it to everybody. It's the Social History of Orthodox Jewry in Imperial Germany by Professor Breuer, Mordechai Breuer. Now he's a Breuer, you know. I think he was the son of Yitzhak Breuer, maybe. And he was a historian in Israel. And he's a Yekki. In other words, he writes about this. He doesn't need to look up footnotes. He lived it, you know. And it's really, truly a very wonderful book. I really recommend it very highly. Anyhow, this is a world of yesterday which no longer exists. When the Jews in Germany, especially the Orthodox, I'm talking about pretty much our middle class, and developed their own particular style. I'm going to get into that right now. Our hero was born smack in the middle of this in 1879. And that means that for somebody, he didn't live long. He died in his 50s. So, from TB, which he had all of his life. That's what I mean by tough life. If he was 56, so it means the first 30, 40 years, not even, 35 years, something like that, of his life was one thing, and then the next 20 years or so was another thing. So the first 35 years was the good years of the Jews of Germany. By the time you get to 1870, the Germans in the German Empire, which was just forming at that time under Bismarck, had reluctantly, perhaps, but nevertheless, solidly, granted the Jews complete and total civil rights. I wouldn't say there was an absence of anti-Semitism, but officially there was. You know what I'm saying? Jews had complete and total civil rights, and then they used it. And the German Jews rose many times to positions of influence and economic power and things like that. Just to give you one example, they set up the General Electric as a Jewish operation in Germany, just one. The petrochemical industry and other things like that. This is the Bismarck years, the Kaiser Wilhelm I and Kaiser Wilhelm II. Now, what about the Frum? I spoke about Rob Hilsheimer the other day. He was a key player in the Frum story because he showed up in Germany, came back from Hungary. Mamish at the very beginning of this period, around 1870, a bit before, and the Hilsheimer Seminary, which sought to really and genuinely combine Torah Derech Eretz, Torah Mata, genuinely, in a Frum way, that is the story of Imperial Germany. Now, that means, and I think I mentioned it a couple weeks ago, that if you want to get down to details to some degree, the German Jewry followed, you know, two axes. Frankfurt, that's one, and Berlin is the other. Frankfurt is a Hirsch, you know, obviously. And the way that all developed, and the Breuers. That's a certain Mahalach. And then there was a different one. They're all Frum, but it's a different one. That's Rav Hildesheimer and the Berlin way of doing Orthodox Judaism, which was, shall I say, a little bit more open, perhaps. That's a very complicated. I can't go into great detail. But let's put it this way. There was a distinct Metzias outside of the Hirschian stuff in Berlin associated with Rav Hildesheimer and his colleagues and the people he attracted and his charisma. And even after he died in about 1899, you had David Zvi Hoffman and people, and man, you know, they built up a whole kehillah of, I think, 2,000 families, which is not tiny, right? And they had a separate kehillah like in Frankfurt, Austritzgemeinde, you know, with their own mikveh, obviously, and their own synagogues, their own school system, and so on and so forth, right? Now, kashrus, of course, the only difference is that Hildesheimer and his successors didn't strive to have bitter relations with the non-Frum. They were very clear that they're Frum and, you know, they're not connected with anything that's un-Frum. But having made that statement, they tried to have good social relations, shall we say, over here, in interesting ways. Okay, now, our hero was born in Hungary, in Oberland. The German Jews, especially under the modern Orthodox system that involved Germany, most people are not going to become big Talmidei Chachamim. He's going to go into business, possibly by the time we're talking about late 19th century professions. They'll be Shomer Torah Mitzvahs, for sure, for sure. They'll have their shiur, you know, once a week, twice a week, whatever it is. In order to staff the institutions, they used to usually bring in people from the outside. In the 1800s, they brought in Hungarians. In the 1900s, they brought in Litvaks. Which is interesting, that's how it was. Because Hungary is the country next door, and Hungary was semi-modern. And in the Oberland, which is the non-Hasidic part, you had people with enough German culture that even though they're very Frum and they had yeshiva education because in Hungary, at the time I'm talking about, unlike Germany, in Hungary there were dozens of yeshivas flourishing, right? These are basically two countries adjacent to each other. Germany and Austria. Austria is sort of German. Adjacent to Austria is Hungary. And I'm talking about the old kingdom of Hungary that existed once upon a time, which is no longer there. It was like four or five times or more the size of Hungary today. Now, that means if you're a German Jew, especially a Frum Jew, so if you really care about yeshiva stuff and all that, you might send your son for a year or two, whatever, not that far away to Hungary, in which there were dozens of yeshivas flourishing. This is not the Litvish yeshivas, it's a separate thing. But, you know, in Unsdorf, and this place, and that place, and the Semyon, there were a lot of Hungarian Oberland, non-Hasidic yeshivas, that were, Pressburg, of course, were doing quite well at that time. So this is an interesting relationship. Now, our hero was born in the Oberland, and, you know, from that kind of background, but as a little kid, his father died, his mother died when he was young. Told he had a hard life. When he was a little boy, you know, around the time he was born, his father moved to Berlin. He was hired by the Hildesheimer community, by the Kehillo, to be like a, I think he had a small shul in Berlin, a stiebel. And in addition to that, he was a principal of the what's called Religionsschule, of the religion school. Now, here we have a tough business. Even somebody like me, I should know this stuff, but it's been never been clear to me exactly the nature of the chinuch system in Berlin. I know that they had, I'm just tell you the best I know, okay? Maybe somebody knows better than me. As far as I know, I repeat, I'm talking about Berlin. I'm not talking about Frankfurt. In Frankfurt, they had a school from kindergarten to 10th grade. That's what they had in Frankfurt, okay? And after 10th grade, you graduated, and the education was not to send you to college. This is Hirsch. But the education was to prepare you at the 10th grade, 15, 16 years old, something like that. Then you go out to the world of business, and you start at the bottom, work your way up. That's the particular mode they have there. I know in America we have K through 12. I get it. It's not exactly the only way to do it. And in Frankfurt, they had the way I just told you. Now, in Berlin, and that means, though, I'll say this, and this is the great achievement of Hirsch, of Senator Fulhirsch, Hirsch, already in the 1850s. I mean, this is his claim to fame. He insisted and built a day school from K to high school, meaning up to 10th grade. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, he had his own ideas. But that means you're a kid, you go to a school which is completely Jewish. And not only that, completely Orthodox. And the holidays are kept, and the mitzvahs are kept, and all the rest of it. Of course, it was within a German context, and, you know, they didn't wear yarmulkes for the English studies. But it's a frum school. It's a Jewish school. Okay, let me be clear about that. For boys and for girls. One for boys, one for girls. Now, that's not what they had everywhere. And as far as I know, in Berlin, the Frum couldn't put that together. Not in the 1800s. Not in the good days. What you had was there for a funny situation. You had a Kehillo with 2,000 families, which is impressive, including their share of millionaires, right? You had the rich Orthodox Jews in Berlin that get everywhere else. You have a yeshiva there in the following sense. You had the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary, where students came from all over the world to study to be rabbis. But that means you already have a high school degree, and you're going now for university studies. Okay? So you spend 5, 6, 7 years, whatever the exact program worked out, half limuni kodesh, half limuni chol, and you end up with a smicha and a PhD. That was the Hildesheimer system. So if you're older, let's say, for example, you're 18, 19, and older, then you can, if you wish to, you can go to that school, which is there to train rabbanim, to train guys who will be rabbis, pulpit rabbis. Like, that's one thing. But as far as I can tell, it's under that, what do you do for chinuch when you're younger than that, if you're not going for rabbi? So, Hildesheimer set it up that you had an elementary school. So in other words, like in America, many places, there's a day school, let's say, for example, up to the 7th grade, 8th grade, something along those lines. Right? You can, that's what it is. But then there's not. For high school, as was the case in America once upon a time, for high school, you got to go to public school. There is nothing else. So instead, though, they have what you and I in America would call Talmud Torah. Maybe I'm talking to a young audience, and you don't know what it was like here once upon a time. But if you went back to America 100 years ago, there weren't any high schools. You know, there was like YU and Tarvada, something like that. That's it. You know? And so everywhere else, you had Talmud Torah, which means that you had, after high school, you had classes. Now, you can take that seriously, or you can take it for a joke. It's well known in America, most of the Talmud Torah thing was a joke. They gave Talmud Torah education, you know, in the afternoon after public school, a bad rep. But it could work. You know, see, really, even, as a matter of fact, now, with the tuitions going through the roof and the corona, all this business. I've heard in the last 5, 6, 7 years, so have you, some parents are going crazy. And I respect it, middle class people. And it's hard to keep up all these tuitions And the schools are pretty ruthless, you know. And you already hear talk of saying like this. Well, maybe we just have a school like Talmud Torah. No, they send the kids to public school. And in the afternoon have a serious Limudei Kodesh program. Not a joke, a serious Limudei Kodesh program. Now, it wouldn't work. I can tell you that from history. But I'm just telling you what they're talking about now on the, what's the right word, social media. And this sort of thing. You had this in Europe. And in Berlin, they took it seriously. As seriously as they could. And so, basically, up to around Bar Mitzvah, Bas Mitzvah, there was a day school. And after that, they had to go to a public school, or the equivalent of public education. They had gymnasiums, all kinds of things like that. And your Limudei Kodesh, you got in a afternoon program in a separate building. I remember in Breuer, in his book or somewhere, used to have, I think I mentioned this before, a Bachurim minyan, which means you had to go to school on Saturday. This is funny. I know it sounds weird to us. But in Europe, they didn't fool around. The government insisted, you're going to school, you got to go on Saturday. There's a whole shout about writing. I get it. I understand that. There's a whole shout about carrying books. But frankly, carrying books you can get around. Yeah, if you look beforehand, if you're careful, you can make that work out. You know, you have your books where they need to be before Shabbos. Yeah, that could be massaged. Writing was the bummer, okay? And this was a perennial problem all throughout the time that we're talking about it. And Rabbi Hirsch and Ilzheimer used to write public letters about writing for school and Shabbos. That's all smooth by itself. But it happened, right? It happened. And I'm just trying to give you a tiny slice into this world. And that means, I'm talking about the Frum kids now in Berlin, from the Frum families. You had to get up real early on Saturday morning. Real early Saturday morning. You had to do what we would call today Hashkama Shachris, you know? And you daven up, like they're doing in the Corona period. Shachris and then Mosef. And you skip laning. Take too long. But let's say, for example, let's say for argument's sake, you had a minion where you skipped a laning. Actually, I think a lot of these Corona minions outside the porch minions that don't have Torahs, I think they did that, right? They do that. So anyhow, you do all the services, the Shachris and Mosef, and then you go to school. You know what I'm saying? And then school's over, 2 in the afternoon, something like that. And you come back for what we call Minchon Shabbos. But these students would have a separate minyan, the Bachurim minyan. Then they would do the Kriyas HaTorah of the day. Isn't that funny? So in other words, let's say, for example, this week is Parshas Ekev. So you and I, for the most part, we're going to go to shul and lay an Ekev in the morning. And then by Shabbos Mincha, we're going to do the next Parsha Re'eh. These guys, as far as I understand, they skipped the laning in the morning because they got to go to public school. They had to. And then in the afternoon, they're going to lane Akif. I don't think they're going to lane Re'eh. Maybe they did, you know, to be kind to Mishnah. This was all done under the Pesach of Rav Hildesheimer. So, in other words, everything I just described you was guided by the Das Torah of that time. This isn't somebody just thought it up. This was with the Das Torah of that time. And this is a different world. So, our hero was orphaned at a young age. His father had been the principal of school but died young. Right? So it must have been a family thing. What shall I say? He grew up in orphanages, which is tough. And it's a tough life. If he's born in 1879, so imagine all during the 1880s and even into the 1890s, this is somebody who's growing up, I think it was a while in Hamburg, somebody raised him for a while, but he basically grew up in orphanages, was a very smart kid. The father was a principal of the school. This was, an afternoon Talmud Torah high school. And he wanted to be like his father. And so what this meant practically was, that as he grew up, he didn't go for a career to be a rabbi, which is interesting. He was very frum, by Teva. And instead, remember, we're talking about the 1890s in Imperial Germany, went to university. Some good universities. Eventually got a PhD. I remember he wrote a dissertation on Goethe. Probably you don't even know who Goethe is, but it's like the German Shakespeare. Let's put it that way. The principal figure in German literature. So, and naturally, being Jewish, he basically wrote a dissertation, Goethe and the Jews. You know, What else he's going to talk about? That's the famous joke. He really did. I think it was called Goethe and the Old Testament. Something like that. Anyway, so now he's a mensch. He has a doctorate. And that's what put him in the late... This puts you around 1900, 1901, 1902, when the guy's like 20, 21, 22. And then the question comes, what do you do with your life? Yeah, he was academically very talented. Now, if he wanted to, he could have pursued to try to get a career in college. That was very hard for a Jew in Germany to get a professor job. Very difficult. A lot of discrimination. There certainly was. On the other hand, if you know the Prote Protem, it could be done. And he was very good. I want you to understand, this is a from Jew who basically did a dissertation in German literature, because he's writing about Goethe. He's writing German culture, German literature. That would be a plus. And based on what I've seen in different places, he had a real shot at getting a job in the university world. There were a number, not many, there were a number of Jews, including a few from Jews, who really were able to make it in the German academic world. That's most unusual, okay? Most of the time, you're Jewish, they blackballed you, they quoted and all the rest of it. But it could be done. And in Berlin, there was two or three famous people like that. And that's not what he chose to do. Instead, it's just very interesting. He has a PhD in classic German literature. That's what it boils down to. He obviously was interested in Jewish stuff. He's a very from guy. But on the other hand, he wasn't a Gemar guy, because otherwise he would have gone to Hildesheimer Seminary and gotten a smicha. I've seen in one or two places they said he did, but I don't believe that's correct. And he certainly never went for the rabbinate. Instead, he was interested in chinuch, in educationism. That's what I wanted to bring out. In other words, being on the front lines and teaching high school kids, I think he fell in love with the idea of teaching high school kids in the highest sense of the word, of being makarev people to Yiddishkeit, because the truth of the matter is, the high school years are the most important years in a person's development. If you go to, let's say, a public school for elementary, you go high school to a frum school, you're in the frum, most of the time. On the other hand, if you go to a frum elementary school and you go to a non-frum high school, you won't be in there. Most of the time, you're not, because the formative years are the teenage years, and this is when the roshim is made on you. Now, in Germany, when he was, how good could the education be? Dicker hours are for the Lumunichol. The best hours of the day are for the public school. And we're talking about when public school worked. We're talking about gymnasiums. Like we say, the elite schools. Because Jews only want to go to good schools. How much time is left over for the Yiddishkeit stuff? You have to know how to be a charismatic teacher of the high school student in order to be able to do this. You understand? In other words, he grasped from the world he grew up in his own experiences and his own intellectual interests, the real essence of chinuch, which is to turn on the kids. Right? What's it all about? It's not even about what you teach them. It's about making a kesher connection and turning on the kids to want to be from after they leave school. This he grew up. He was a young man. He was intuited it, and he ends up becoming a teacher. This is what he chooses to do. He taught in the high school where he himself had attended, and his father had attended, that Talmud Torah High School. No, it was the afternoon school. But he was very good at it. Now, if I remember correctly, he was a Tanakh teacher or something like that. And a lot of these people, like I said before, Gemar wasn't for him. That's what it seems. But on the other hand, there's a lot of, especially in Germany, the Hirschianism, there's Tanakh, there's Halacha, there's other things like that. And this is what he wanted to devote his life to. Okay? And he was a charismatic teacher. And if you like it and you're good at it, it's interesting. Now, it's an interesting lifestyle because the whole teaching is in the afternoon. Maybe also taught, for all I know, in the elementary school in the morning. I don't know. But he loved what he was doing. On the other hand, it's not a high-paying job at all. It's not a high-paying job at all. The reason I'm in, but it's an honorable job. Now, doing all this, he had what you would call, this was interesting to me, he had shemush in the real world of chinuch. You know what I'm saying? Not blah, 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 theories and speeches and this, that, and the other, and terms or convention. He's there with the real kids. It's like somebody saying today, the kids should not have cell phones. They got cell phones. Either you see them or you don't see them. You have to understand. This is what it is. Now, are you willing to work in that world? And once you realize the kids have cell phones with everything that's implied by that. That's what I mean when I say it's in the real world. It's, the young mind, the young personality, is what attracted and fascinated him. So here you have somebody who is interested in educationism, meaning the theories and the structures and the curriculum, the right way of doing chinuch, what's the essence of the educational process. Now, by the way, Sam Samuel Hirsch was like this as an avocation. One of the things he was not only a rabbi of a kehillah, of course he was that, right, and an orator and a writer, but he was interested in educationism, the theories of education. He writes about this a great deal. He was into Montessori, Pestalozzi, and all this stuff. So our hero had that education shtick with him, okay? Now I want to remind you, if you're living in Berlin as he did, you know, the Talmidei Chacham are associated with the seminary and most of that stuff. He's in the world of the front lines of chinuch. When he is 25, it's interesting, his sister married a very unusual guy, Bieberfeld. They're really unusual. These are, you know, Gekesha types that don't exist. And he apparently had a big influence. Bieberfeld, Edward Bieberfeld, Chaim Bieberfeld, was from... It's a whole world. It's hard to recapture. Edward Bieberfeld was a... Let me put it this way. He only got married when he was 40 years old. That's where I'm going with all this. He was from Breslau, which is a city in eastern Germany. Now it's in Poland. Breslau was a place, and his father was like a dayan there or something like that. And he grew up born in 1864, which I know doesn't mean anything to you, but these are the years of the rise of the Reform and Conservative. As a matter of fact, the Conservative made their headquarters in Breslau. The Jewish Theological Seminary in Germany, the famous institution, was in Breslau, where Gratz was and Zachary Frankel and the others. So the Conservative was a very big hashpa, very big. And the Frum were really on the defensive. And there was an Orthodox element. And by the way, the Reform was also big. These are famous stories of the rise of the Reform movement. Abraham Geiger versus Rabbi Tichtin in Breslau. These are well-known tales. And so when this Bieberfeld was growing up, he's basically the only Frum guy in town, him and his brother, something like that. You know what I mean? No, even the kids in the Orthodox community weren't really Frum. So when you're like that, oddball out, either it makes you weak or it makes you strong, right? In this case, it made him strong, and he grew up being very stark, and eventually came to Berlin and went to the Hildesheimer Seminary. I don't know why. He didn't finish the Hildesheimer and get his smicha until he was 30 years old. These are rather late dates in life. Then he taught for a while in this religion school. And then for whatever, I remember his father had a shul in Berlin. You don't need to know all these details. The point I'm getting at is that when he's 36 years old, he decided he wanted to become a doctor, an MD. And he went to medical school 4 years, then became a doctor, and then he got married to Deutschlander's sister. So she's also an orphan. This is just an interesting story, because a big age difference. And age differences are really not so uncommon in Imperial Germany. That's a very important part of our story, because the German Jews, the Orthodox Jews, imbibed a lot of the bourgeois middle-class values. And I'm going to say something today that a lot of listeners will nod their head either up and down or right and left. But in the Frum world, not the Ex world, in the classic Torah world, shall we say, Hasidic world, you get married before you're financially ready to do so. Agreed? A guy and a girl get married. They're 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. Yeah. Now, if you got rich parents, that's one thing. But if you don't have rich parents, how's it going to work out? It'll work out. This is the world we live in. Am I right or am I wrong? Okay? Basically, the chassan and the kal jump off of Niagara Falls and they hope they'll land. Yep. Eventually, he'll get a job in this area, in that area. Or as we say, Jade, we'll go to school or something like that, or the girl will go to school, and you know, it'll be rough for a while, but then they'll land on their feet sooner or later, you hope. This is a big violation of Hilchos middle class, even America today. Tell a non-Frum Jew, you know, those of you about Chubas know what I'm talking about. Tell a non-Frum Jew, tell your family he's not from, well, I'm going to yeshiva, I'm not going to get any degree in anything, I'll be 23, 24, 25, we'll marry a girl, and then we'll figure out what we're going to do. They're horrified. Because a violation of Hilchos middle class. In middle class, and in the Gemara, I mean, the Rambam talks like this also. first you get a job, you know, then you build a house, as he said, then you get married. Right? I mean, you hear the part. How are you going to support a wife? Right? So, if you're in Imperial Germany in the early 20th century, basically, if you're a boy, you finish school, if you're like in Frankfurt in 10th grade, then you go into business. It takes you a decade to start making some decent money, as we would say today, to have enough money in the bank, then now you're able to support a wife, then hopefully a family. And so people didn't get married till later, meaning after 25, 30 even, things like it wasn't uncommon at all. So the girl's like 19 or 20, and the boy's like 20, 29, 30. This is not rare at all, not rare at all. And it totally comported with the middle class values. You know what I'm saying? It's just interesting. Today in America, they're all submission, one way or the other. The average girl who's 19 doesn't want to marry a guy who's 30 or 29. The average, you know. Even if you say, listen, the guy finished school now and this and that and the other, he's a position. Usually someone wants somebody closer in age. It happens. Everything happens. Everything happens. I'm talking about, you know, Derek Claw. Now, the reason I mention this is, Susan Bieberfeld, who married his sister and was now Rabbi Dr. Bieberfeld, doctor in the sense of MD, and became a very chashuva person in the Berlin community. Besides being a famous frum physician, you know, with all the legends that go along with that, he was a big Talmud Chacham because he learned with his father in Breslau. You know, he learned literally, not the German style, but yeshiva style. He learned with his father, you know, Shas and Poskim and so forth. And he taught in the religion school. And so, I don't know all the details, but they all must have known each other socially. So here's our hero, 25 years old and not married. Now he undertakes to teach in this school. And he spends a good from 19, how old was he when he got his PhD? In Germany, he'd be like 23, something like that. So that would put him around 1902, 1903, some of those years. So he spent a decade up to the First World War. So from the time you're in your early 20s to you're in your early 30s, as an unmarried teacher, not with a big salary, it's an honorable position, but he's very, as we would say today, he's a very charismatic high school rebbe. That's how we would describe today. And he was. And in Germany, the best sense of the chinuch, they went on trips on Sunday, and they, you know, he was just very good. You know, the students really liked him. Now, here's the problem. And his sister is now married to a very chashuv guy in the community. His sister, I imagine, was 25. I imagine, or 24, 25. The husband was now 40. That's just an interesting situation. And they immediately had five kids, and then she died. That's what happened after a decade. You know, the human side. But that's who our hero is. Now, it's not surprising. Well, let me put it this way. He fell in love with a girl, one of his students, and the girl fell in love with him. Which I've heard of cases like that. You understand? No, there's a... Here's a guy who's 25, 28, 29, something like that. And there's a girl in the high school from the community, from a wealthy family too, who is from a chashuva family. And they fell for each other. I've had a friend. It happens. But it's a big age difference. Now, if I was the father of the girl, I wouldn't be crazy. But also, I don't want my daughter, if she's 16, 17 years old, fall in love with a guy who's like 29, 30. On the other hand, it wasn't unheard of in Imperial Germany. And the problem is he's the wrong class, meaning he was poor relative to the family. And in Germany, if you're a rich family, you got to marry a rich chassan. You know what I'm saying? And the girl, as time went on, their love intensified, is what you're saying. You know, nothing bad happened. Everything totally honorable. He was a frum guy, very frum. And the girl was too. And they wanted to get married, you know, and they don't care what anybody says. And the family moved heaven and earth and eventually brought charges against him and things like this. It was in court. It was quite a scandal, even though, I repeat, nothing ever happened. And nothing unseemly ever happened. And this was the big crisis. Now, one of the problems with him is he had the TB, the tuberculosis. This before he had the penicillin, which was stuff that stayed with you your whole life. Eventually finished you off. And in his particular case, very sad. The TB settled in a place in his body, which prevent him from having children, which is part of what can happen. And it didn't matter. The girl wanted to marry him. He wanted to marry the girl. Now, all this reaches... So this is the story that dominates his late 20s and early 30s, as we'd say today. Matter of fact, I'm wrong. His early 30s, like 30 to 35. And I don't know what happened with the court case and all the rest of it. The parents prevented her from marrying the guy. Now, but they wanted to end love anyway. And isn't this a movie? And wait a minute, it gets better. In the middle of all this, World War I breaks out. World War I was going to transform everything because eventually the Kaiser fell and Germany fell apart. And then the Weimar Republic, and just life was very different, right? The Masuderdickel life that had been up to 1914 is different from what happens afterwards. Now, he was drafted. How old was he? 34 years old? 1909? 35 years old at the time the war breaks out. He's in the reserves. He has a PhD in German Lit. And so he wasn't a private first class set in the front lines. He had a high education, and therefore they made him an officer. And eventually, before too long, they sent him to the Eastern Front, which means that in 1915, not long after the war started, the German army conquered Lithuania. That's the point I'm getting at. This is a general part of what happened in World War One. I have a whole series that I did last year, I guess, on the experience of Orthodox Jews in the First World War, particularly in the Eastern Front, a whole bunch of videos, which I think might be on my new YouTube channel, if you're into that. Anyway, and the German army, pretty quickly, in 1915, remember, the war started in late July, August, September of 1914, and by July, August of 1915, the German army had driven the Russians away, and they had conquered Lithuania and Poland, central Poland, which means the German army now ruled several million Jews in Lithuania, Belarus, Ukraine, and Poland. And the question was what to do with them. This is a giant parsha, which I said before that I did a series on. This is fascinating. Our hero played an important role in this because he was sent to serve in the German army occupation forces in Lithuania. Since, remember, he's got a PhD and all the rest of it. He wasn't very intellectual in the German way. On the other hand, he knows Hebrew very well. And so his job, which makes sense from a personnel point of view, is to translate German documents into Hebrew. Like if the government wants to issue a proclamation or something like that, he should translate in Hebrew. And if the local Jews want to send something to the German army to discuss something, they can write it in Hebrew and he'll translate into German. That sort of thing. That's okay with me. Here becomes part of a very fascinating parsha, because the German army occupying Poland and Lithuania played a seminal role in the transformations that hit Eastern European Jewry. Because the First World War was a terrible blow. Even though the German army did not go against the Jews at all. This is not World War II, this is World War I. This is the Kaiser's army. But life in general was tough because you had military occupation. You had, wartime conditions, scarcity of food, malnutrition, people drafted for work battalions, high taxes. The German army ran it in favor of the German army. It wasn't that great for the population themselves, even though it wasn't anti-Semitic per se. And here's the point. He's an educationist. A whole long process unfolded, which is a fascinating process, where the German Jews wanted to use this opportunity. The German army now controls Eastern Europe. I'm going to concentrate my remarks on Lithuania because that's where he was. There's a separate story for Poland, right? So Lithuania was now occupied by the German army, has a large Jewish population. How should the Germans relate to them? Now, I can tell you right now, for various reasons, the Russians had expelled a lot of people, whatever. Jewish life collapsed under this pressure. And let's talk about specifically the area of Chinuch. So the cheders fell apart. The whole populations were disrupted. Starvation. The chadarim that existed beforehand fell apart. So there's no chinuch. Now, what do you do for the younger generation? Immediately, all kind of Jewish groups, especially the Zionists and the Bundists, immediately said, we're going to set up schools for the children. We'll replace the cheders. What did Ephraim do? And they did. What did Ephraim do? They were like deers in a headlight. The Rabbonim were barely trying to hold it with their heads above ground, you know, and survive. And they didn't know what to do. Here come these German Jews. The Reform showed up, the Conservative and the Orthodox. The Reform particularly wanted to affect the Eastern European Jews in a Reform way. But even the German army realized that's not a great idea for the Reform. And so by the time the process is over, it's a long story, the German general staff hooked up with the Reform Jews in Germany who were highly Germanized and highly organized. They had something that Hirsch had set up called the Freie Vereinigung. Let's call it the German Agudas Israel. Let's just call it that. They were an organization which mobilized Yekkies with influence and with experience in education and administration to come to Lithuania and try to help the Lithuanian Jews survive the war in a firm way. And so our hero, like a key element in this, he said, whatever was before the old cheder system and zero chinuch for girls, that's over as a result of the war. I didn't do it, the war did it. Now what? I suggest, he and people like him said, we should introduce the German system into Lithuania in a totally firm way, because the German system is very firm, and we can adjust it for firm conditions. So basically, this is the introduction of day schools into Lithuania, firm day schools, for boys and for girls. It's not Beis Yaakov, as we'll see in a minute. Beis Yaakov happened in Poland, but it's its own way. And he and Rabbi Karlbach and some other people got together, and they made a lot of experiments to try to set up what kind of chinuch works in Lita. Where the parents were also interested. You should have what we in America call Limudachon, Limudakosh, English and Hebrew, or over there. By the way, it won't be English. We'll be in Lithuania, we'll be in Polish, we'll be in German. What exactly will be the content of the Limudachon? And what's the proportion in the day? Is it a firm system in which it's Rov Limudakosh and Mi Limudachon? Do you want a good English? Do you want a bad English? All these issues had to be worked out. And World War I was the laboratory of experiments. He and Karlbach and the others tried to figure out, because they were living in Lithuania, what will work with this particular population to make it from schools. And they made a bunch of mistakes. But you learn from mistakes. You know what I'm saying? They set up some schools and they all went not from this, not the other. You learn from mistakes. And he had like a hothouse laboratory for figuring out what is the right way to go in terms of chinuch in the new age. And basically, how do you take a Hirschian type of school and transform it to fit the Lithuanian reality? This is a fascinating subject. And by the time it's over, he evolved the Yavne. Because he's the one who made the Yavne. Now, many of you don't know what Yavne is. Maybe if you're in Cleveland, you have Yavne. This was the equivalent of the Beis Yaakov system for girls and the day schools for boys that grew up in Lithuania. The Deutschland is the one who made it. After all, he's an educated guy. He understands educationism, curriculums, classrooms, buildings, the professional training, all the stuff that was unheard of in Lithuania, right? Unheard of. He's a firm guy, obviously, and he plunges into this work, and like I said before, do you want schools for girls? Is it K-12? Is it K-6? What are you teaching the girls at high school? Now, for boys, do you have yeshivas? Do you have high schools? If you have high schools, what's the proportion of Limudakosh, Limudakol? What's the general gang? You know what I'm saying? Is it Aguda? Is it Mizrahi? Because those issues were already in Lithuania in the First World War. It was pretty clear that if you try to push an Aguda anti-Mizrahi type of school system, it won't go. You know what I'm saying? So you have to evolve something which is from, is sort of Aguda, but, you know, it also has Mizrahi elements in it. And so what developed over there was just something very fascinating. Now, this takes you through 1915, 16, 17, and 18. This is what's going on in Lithuania while the rest of the world was engaged in World War I. Now, our hero was at the heart of the whole thing. I don't know if he ever turned back to Germany during these years. It would really be a great movie to say that the whole affair with the girl broke his heart and he stayed their way. You know, that would be a fantastic movie. But I'll tell you one thing. His work was of seminal importance, and when the war was over, and there was now a new country called Lithuania, which I just did a series here in Baltimore in the videos. When the war was over, So chinuch was a giant question, because chinuch is going to affect the next door. And the Zionists had gotten their act together, and the Bundists had gotten their act together, and they immediately set up whole school systems, which were very good. One was called Tarbut, one was called the Volksschule. All over Lithuania, they had these new type of schools with non-from teachers, excellent education in a Zionist way, if that's what you're into, or in a Yiddishist way, if that's what you're into. But forget the from stuff. And even the biggest rabbanim, who, being yeshivish, never would have been comfortable with the mudichol and this and that and the other, you know. But they realized they got to wake up and smell the coffee. And they basically turned to Deutschlander and said, you stay here in Lithuania and set up a system that the government will recognize of day schools that'll work. You know what I'm saying? Notice the haters are over. The new conditions have destroyed them. And so we need what we call in America day schools. Term serve day schools. From day schools. And when it came to girls, he had to start from scratch. There's no background in Judaism for teaching girls. And he did. So understand this well. He was an official of the Lithuanian government for 3-4 years, something like that, in the Ministry of Education. Because after all, he's a German PhD. Ministry of Education, in charge of Jewish education, specifically in charge of the Frum branch, and working to get money and resources and teacher training programs and teacher colleges and curriculums and this and that and the other to make an entire network of schools throughout Lithuania. And that is what happened. There's no Beis Yaakov over there. Instead, you had Yavne. And from 1920 till Hitler came in 1940, Hitler and Stalin in 1940, wherever you went in Lithuania, there's always 2 or 3 schools. And one is the Yiddishist type school, one is the Zionist type school, and one is the Yavne. Okay? That was the firm option. So it's like in America, we call it Torah Mesorah. So in Europe, in Lithuania, it's called the Yavne. And it wasn't exactly like Beis Yaakov. It's very interesting. I've spoken about this at great length. There's a great quote that I use from Baruch Horowitz, who was the head of the Agudas Rabbanim in Lithuania, where he said, you know, we believe in teaching not the Frumkeit and from the Frumkeit to the Torah the way they do in Germany, but we want to teach the Torah and lead from the Torah to lead the Frumkeit. Some words to that effect. And the Yavne system, especially for the women, developed into very high educated and Jewish from females, I'm going to tell you right now. So he played a seminal role in the development of Jewish education, the way it developed in Lithuania, boys and girls. You know, the big question was, what do you do for the boys after you finish 8th grade? I mean, the Rosh Hashivas obviously want to put them on a yeshiva track. On the other hand, a lot of parents don't want yeshiva track. The second, well, do you do Agudah stuff? Do you do Mizrahi stuff? How do you teach her of cook? You know what I mean? Anyway, it was a big issue. By the way, just to be clear, the way he worked it out, the way it unfolded, again, this is under Das Torah. The people who ran the Yavne system, I noticed their Vada Chinuch, as we would call today, were people like the Bonavisha Rav, the Telzer Rav, the Kovner Rav, you know, Gedolei Yisrael. But these men were very flexible and practical. They realized what the situation was in Lita in the 1920s and 30s. And the same way Baron Cutler and people like that had to twist and bend with Dr. Kamenetsky and make the term so work in America in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. You know, in some places you have mixed classes, and some places not. And some places you allow this, and some places you don't. You know, Das Torah. Literally Das Torah. This is what involved in Lithuania with our hero. Now watch this. In between this, this is what he did for several years, but he didn't live in Lithuania. He was there for periods of time. Then he came back and went to Vienna. Now, I don't understand this exactly, but it seems to me in Vienna, which is in Austria, not Germany, but it is German, he'd probably been invited to set up some kind of a Yavne type situation there. You see? Because I believe he made a teacher seminary there, a from teacher seminary, because people are already realizing, even the Gedolim, that, you know, changes are necessary in the Chinuch. We have to provide some kind of a system of Limud HaKodesh with Limud HaChol in some fashion or another. But it has to be done in the right way, of course. It's a very delicate subject. And this is the guy who's going, you know, there's somebody who's in the forefront of this because he has a PhD in German. He's an educationist. I'm sure he read up all the education magazines that come out all the time. This is a subject that interests him. And he was fascinated by young people. Now, listen to this. Here's where the movie kicks in. When he moved to Vienna, this is 1919, so he would be 40 years old. This girl who was in love with him, he was in love with her, she ran away from home. She by now, she's in her 20s. You know, she'd be on the parents' shoes. Then they came to Vienna, they got married. So here you have, you know, a movie and a half. But all from, I didn't say anything wrong. You know what I mean? No, nothing bad happened. But she said, I guess, let's say I'm 25, whatever. You know, this is what I want to marry. 26, I want to marry. And they did. And the parents broke off with her. It's a contest story. And as they say before, unfortunately, because of his TB, he couldn't have kids. It's a rough business. But they were happily married. And he became active in Vienna. Now, remember, he's spending part-time in Lithuania and part-time in Vienna. It's quite a life. What's happening in Vienna in the early 20s when he's living there, and now as a newlywed? The Agoda is taking off. Remember the big Agoda convention of 1923? That's the movie you saw that they passed around recently on the YouTube, the Chofetz Chaim and all these other people, the Knesset Agadola. Yeah, Agoda was trying to get off the ground and become a real organization. That really succeeded, but, you know, they made a shot at it. But one big problem is Kesef Menolan. The Agoda is there to support Torah education. There were whole networks of yeshivas, yeshiva katanas, similar institutions, the institutions that are type to he's the Yavne. But the problem is no money. No money. And so they set up a Karen HaTorah, which basically means a fundraising operation. And they put Deutschlander, our hero, in charge of it. I'm not exactly sure why. But he wasn't a rabbi, you know, he's an educationist. Obviously, they must have had in mind that with his education, even though he's a frum guy, totally frum guy, totally woo, real frum, you know, he carried a Tanakh with him all the time, said to him, you know, that sort of thing. But since he's a bucky in German literature and in Goethe and who knows what, he will be able to be a good face to the non-frum world and maybe raise money among them for this subject. Because the war had ruined the frum millionaires. It took a few years for them to get back on their feet. You know, remember, Germany used to be the headquarters of the rich frum Jews. And I think many of you know, after the First World War, there was unbelievable inflation when the money just wasn't worth anything. That's part of the Versailles Treaty in the aftermath. And so everybody was ruined economically. It took them a number of years to start to get back on their feet. Because a successful businessman, even if he starts again from scratch, you know, a little while we'll get back on his feet. And so, make a long story short, they made Deutschlander, the head of the Karen HaTorah, he should go around the world and try to Europe and places like that and tries to raise money for these causes. And again, you know, I've seen some people say, oh, he raised hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's baloney. He raised like $30,000-$40,000, which was a lot of money once upon a time, but it's not $1 million at all. And that means that you raise 30 or 40 grand, and then you send 100 to this yeshiva, 200 to that yeshiva, 1,000 here, 1,000 there. No one has done yet what could be a very interesting talk or article on the Kesef situation in the 1920s and 30s, which is very interesting because you can't run a place without money, and a lot of places there was no money, and they had schools of all kinds, yeshivas, whatever, and how did they do it? How did he do it? Part of it came from the Joint Distribution Committee, the American Jews, but that was a very complex and complicated process. Maybe I'll talk about that some other time. All I know is he went to England, to France, to this. He didn't come to America, but he was friends with Leo Jung, who became the big rabbi in New York, right? Leo Jung went to the Holy Simon Seminary, so they knew each other from Berlin, from before the war. And Leo Jung, it's always interested me. He had a very modern shul, correct, in Manhattan. But he was always, from day one, he was very big into the Beis Yaakov movement and things like that because he was friends with Deutschlander. And he also had a rich shul, relatively speaking. He sent him money. So in other words, that's one of his funding sources. And he got involved in this whole Yekesh enterprise, trying to raise money for the yeshivas. And in general, let me say this. In general, the 1920s, showed a turn of the German Jews towards Lithuania. This is very interesting. You didn't have in Germany, after the First World War and after the death of W.C. Hoffman in 1921, any rabbi in Germany that I know of who says, I pass this way, I don't care what anybody else thinks. They're always looking over their shoulder. what is the Lithuanian thing? What is the Chaim Meiser thing? Or something like that. And it's just very interesting. This Dr. Deutschlander I'm talking about today, he's the one who hooked up with Avram Elia Kaplan, the famous one. And together they helped make the Yavna system in Lithuania. And then he brought him to be the head of the Hildesheimer Seminary in Germany. They just, these connections are interesting. So the Litvishizing, shall I use that term, of German Orthodox Jewry is a feature of the post-war world. I'll use simple language. Prior to the First World War, if you were from in Germany and you wanted a more intense education, there weren't many like that, you went to Hungary. You know what I'm saying? If you were a Yaki and you wanted more than was available chinuch-wise, in Germany, you wanted something intense, you went to Hungary. You went to Pressburg. You know, one of those type of yeshivas, of which there were many and they were flourishing. After the First World War, you usually went to Lithuania. You went to Telz, you know, Tzmir, Slobodan, places like that. This is just an interesting phenomenon. Now, I mean, that's a whole schmooze by itself. So here we have somebody who's in his 40s, who has another 10 years or so to live. You know, died at 56, so, you know, something like 10, 12 years. That's when he met Tzar Schneer. That's when he got in the Beis Yaakov movement. No, here's somebody who came with a big experience, a big reputation, and when he got involved in the Aguda, and he went to Poland, and in Poland, Tzar Schneer had already started her operation on a nickel and dime basis. And she had the ideas, but she did not have any PhD, right? She didn't have any educationist training. He teamed up with her, and she put it in his hands, and she said, tell me what to do. And he played a seminal role in the spread of the Beis Yaakov, which was frummer than the Yavne in the sense of frumkeit. Not that the Yavne was unfrum, but the nature of it was it only appealed to a very right-wing frum constituency. After all, Poland, southern Poland, which he was, headquarters of Hasidism, there you had a population like that. The difference between Beis Yaakov and Yavne is fascinating. I just don't have time to go into it. But he made the Beis Yaakov because he said, here's how we're going to set up the education stuff, and we'll have the curriculums, and we'll have the chavrot, the workbooks, and we'll have a grading process, you know, first grade, second grade, third grade, and we'll set up a teacher seminary, we'll have summer camps, and we will create the tashtit, the, what's the right word, the framework, the background for an entire system, which the Beis Yaakov system spread pretty doggone fast. And so, already in the 20s and 30s, it started to spread more and more. So, a big constituency, and again, they were fighting against the Zionist schools, they're fighting against the Yiddish schools, and who knows what other type of schools. It was a chinuch war, but a war, a challenge either brings out the best or the worst, right? In this case, I think it made a fight real hard, and the tragedy, of course, is the tuberculosis took him over. You understand? So Tzar Schneer had the cancer, and he had the tuberculosis, and they both died in 1935. He could have lived another 20 years. Who knows? Holocaust, I don't know. You know, that's a speculation. But this is why he became famous. It's funny. All the other things I told you until now, I don't think anybody ever heard of. If you say Beis Yaakov, which is something that involved in the last 12, 13 years of his life, that made him world famous. Because of all the projects I talked about, the Beis Yaakov was the one that took off and is still with us today. Beis Yaakov is an Iker constituent element, obviously, of the frum world in the 20th century and the 21st century, growing all the time. And therefore, his role in there is what made him famous. So I'm talking about somebody who had a difficult life. His wife perished in Auschwitz after his death. There are many sad elements of the story, romantic and sad. But on the other hand, look what he accomplished. So I said before, this is somebody who, and I have to finish this up because I'm running out of time. This is somebody who lived a life in the world of chinuch in the highest sense of chinuch. You and I are the beneficiaries of these educationists. There aren't too many. Not too many. And even today, there's some serious problems, as we all know, in the world of chinuch out there. But we try. You know, we try. People who think in conceptual terms about what the goals should be, the frameworks, how to adjust it to the kids, in a totally frum way, in other words, in the most sensitive frum way, there are not too many of them. And Dr. Leo Deutschlander, Shmuel Deutschlander, was one. And with that, I'm almost at the end of my hour, so I will bid you good day.